Hitchcock reel too. We were talking about after the outbreak of the Second World War, you attended farm camps, and you were telling me what exactly you do on a typical farm camp, this one at Garstang, a duck farm. But if you'd tell us a bit more detail of what would happen when you got set up there.
We thought it was pretty wonderful. It was a great time. We were all together, and we tied up tomatoes, picked tomatoes, side-shooted tomatoes. We turned into little green monsters. If you've ever picked tomatoes, or side-shooted tomatoes, or picked peas, and worked in the fields, you know that your hands become stained, your face becomes stained. If you rub your nose because of flies buzzing around, and there were many of those, you became rather green. We also introduced ourselves to the local pub, and we used to sneak out. But that would be only on one night during the period. We also played the local side cricket. We played tennis because we'd taken our cricket gear and our tennis gear with us. So it was, I suppose in some ways, rather like Baden-Powell at Brownsea Island in 1907, where these young lads from mill towns came out. We also dug latrines. And I remember one lad, Reggie Redfern, who did more or less turn green because his feces turned green as well. He ate so many peas. Sadly, Reggie is now dead. He became a doctor in later life. The other thing that we did, apart from roaming the countryside, climbing mountains, teaching ourselves how to rock climb, teaching ourselves how to pothole. The other thing was that I became a fire watcher.
Well, tell me about that.
My reason for becoming a fire watcher was simple. The school had to be protected. We had no idea what was going to happen. This will be in 1941. And the real incentive was that I was paid a shilling a night. When I watched, I paid a shilling. We lived on little camp beds, rather like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. We were the Seven Dwarfs. And there was one member of staff and two lads who were to man the stirrup pumps and put out any fires that might arise.
This was in the school buildings?
In the school buildings. And now, in order to do this, this was in an old school, the old grammar school. In order to do this, I had to be trained. So I joined a fire service course and was trained in the art of stirrup pump manipulation. And it was really quite an arduous course.
So what were you learning? Tell me a bit about it.
We learnt how to put out a fire. And the main threat was from incendiaries. We learnt how to put out an incendiary. We had a two-way switch on a stirrup pump. And the first was a spray, the second was a jet. And you had a bucket of water and a pumper. So the person pumped in the bucket of water, and out came the spray. You first tackled the incendiary bomb, then later you tackle the fire. Now, in order to pass this course, I and one of the school teachers, Miss Lucas, went in to the fire hut. And we had a long hose from the stirrup pump, and the fire we had to put out was really quite alarming. It was a small brick building. At one end were furniture, old furniture, packing cases, and this had been covered in waste oil. In the middle of this, the fireman who came in with us set off an incendiary bomb, an authentic incendiary bomb. And Miss Lucas, who, sadly for her, had got hold of the nozzle end, started to put it out. That is the incendiary bomb. And I watched in horror as her hand, the skin on her hand, suddenly shriveled up. I grabbed the thing from her, the nozzle, and she put her hand behind. At the time, fire was licking over the roof and singeing the back of my hair underneath the tin hat that I was wearing. And I finished off putting the fire out. She'd put the incendiary out. I put out the fire. And the fire was a mass of burning furniture and oil, which was creeping across the floor to us, huddled up at the far end of this hut. The hut was only a matter of about, well, like a small garden shed. And we came out, they treated rather, and I thought in rather cavalier fashion, Miss Lucas's hand, and she went to school the next day, bandaged, and remained bandaged for quite some time. I never really did find out what her hand was like after all this, but I'd earned my spurs, and I was an accredited fire watcher, and later on, my pay went up to 3 shillings during the week, and 4 and 6 at the weekend, which, if you did 2 shifts, 7 and 6 a week. The 7 and 6 meant that you were quite rich. After all, you could go for a Saturday night dance, which we did at the Imperial Ballroom.
Now, what about, I mean, did anything ever happen while you were at the school? I mean, or was it just a precautionary measure? Did nothing? Was the school ever bombed? Or?
The school was never bombed. Cohn was out of the bombing. We could go up on the hills above Cohn and see the bombing of Manchester. Manchester was bombed. Manchester would be about 30 miles away. Accrington was bombed, and people were killed in Accrington, which was even nearer.
Now, what about, can I ask you other air raid precautions? I mean, did you have a full-scale blackout?
Yes.
At home? Can you tell us about that?
We made our own blackout, and we did have air raid wardens. They were coming round to check your blackout from the outside.
Now, how did you make it? What method?
It was we bought cloth on the market. It was blackout cloth. And these were made into curtains, which you hung up in the normal way. But often with imperfectly made blackout curtains, you did get the outline of the window shining, well, a faint outline around the outsides of the curtains. And you'll be told that some people, and in the grammar school where I was, Cohn Grammar School, they made blackout curtains. Well, they were not curtains, really. They were boards which were put up because there were very big windows in these schools, very high, and they were made on frames and put up and put in position by means of pegs. And I remember the chemistry lab had these... I suppose it would be some sort of almost tarpaulin material, which was put up on the huge windows of the chemi lab. And Mickey Robinson, the chemistry teacher, thought it would be a wonderful idea to put chemistry formula on these. And he did, in chalk. And on one occasion, when he went out and shouldn't have done, we put the Bunsen burners on the high-pressure taps, and we had a battle of Bunsen burners, and I'm afraid quite a lot of the chemistry formula got washed away. I remember a lad called Alec Riley, who later went into the Merchant Navy, thinking it was great fun to alter the chemistry formula by a fine jet from a Bunsen burner. I don't know whether kids would ever do this these days. We didn't get into trouble. The floor was very wet. I think Mickey Robinson realised that he shouldn't have left a chemistry lab at all.
Now, what about, did you have an air raid shelter? I know you weren't raided, but did you have an Anderson or a Morrison?
We did not have an air raid shelter. The very first time an aircraft came over and we had an alert right at the very beginning of war, we went under the stairs. And my father said, a bomb's dropped. In fact, a bomb did drop, or a stick of bombs. And they were dropped over Tum Hills. Tum Hills were... an old Roman encampment, and they reckoned that the farmer was out with a light showing, and this aircraft dropped its bombs on him. But I think it was an aircraft struggling to get back, jettisoning its bombs, not too careful where it dropped them. But we did have the craters. We all went up to have a look. We did get the occasional aircraft coming down in our area. Unfortunately, the first one that came down was one of our Spitfires, hit the top of a moor, and the pilot was killed. And the town streamed out to look at this Spitfire that had disintegrated. And the lads came back with bits of Spitfire. And that was a trophy. And did not feel, because they couldn't realise, I'm sure, the anguish of the pilot being killed.
Did you go out to visit the site?
I did, along with everybody else. And I brought a bit back, and I got some nuts and bolts, which I used on my pushbike later on in life. Equally, an aircraft came down, a German aircraft came down not far away. It had been hit somewhere, or had come to grief and landed not too far from us. Incidentally, going back in time, the Hindenburg had crossed where we were, and we were aware of seeing the Hindenburg going across North Lancashire.
Now, what about rationing? How did that affect food and clothing? Food, perhaps, first. How did that affect you?
We had ration books. We had the black market. We had grow your own. With all those different sources of food, being on the fringe of the country, having an allotment ourselves, we grew a lot of our own food. We didn't have hens, but many people gave up their egg ration to have hens, and they were able to feed hens and improve their diet. But my mother was a ingenious, she was a good cook, and she was able to keep us going. In fact, people always said we were much more healthy in the war than later on. The amount of sugar, for example, was cut. We didn't have many sweets. We didn't have bananas, but we had plenty of turnips, peas, cabbage, potatoes, new potatoes, spring onions, things of that kind. We fed pretty well, and we used to go up into the Yorkshire Dales and get hams. My relatives were farmers, and they used to kill their own pigs and cure their own hams, and we would get hams from them.
Clothing rationing?
Clothes didn't really worry me unduly. I got two older brothers, so I got reach-me-downs if necessary. The very first dance I went into a... my brother had given me his suit that he bought before the war. He'd now grown out of it. So I went to a dance in a suit. I felt very posh then. Equally, we went to school quite simply wearing blazers and school uniform, blazers, grey flannels. We didn't have elaborate clothes. My grandmother knitted me a pair of rugby socks, which when I... you couldn't buy them very easily. When I went out into the muddy fields playing rugby, because they were not particularly well drained then, they shrank eventually. So, but I wore them throughout my school life because I was very keen on sport as a young lad.
So, clothing, not a thing. Tell me about the recreation centre that you had. Tell me about sport. What were your sporting activities? Was it mainly rugby? Or
no. I played everything under the sun. We did everything that we possibly could. We learnt cricket by watching the people in the Lancashire League. This is before the war. We saw quite, I suppose, enterprising people like Leary Constantine, Armour Singh, and others, too many to mention. These guys were our first glimpse of Test match players, and they were stars. But the local amateurs were equally pretty good. I saw a lad called Jim Goth face up to Constantine's bouncers and not flinch, although he was hit quite often. And he got a good 50. And in those days, if you got 50, then you had a collection. But aping these people, we learnt to play strokes, we learnt to bowl, and we bowled up against a wall if there was no one else to play with. We would hit a ball against a wall and hit it back, and so on and so on. That you played cricket in summer, in the summer holidays, with other lads as long as the daylight lasted. We played football, and not far from where I lived was a football town, Burnley, and they were in the First Division. And one of the first things to think about on a Saturday was, how did Burnley do? Quite often they did pretty well. But I never really went to watch Burnley. I was too busy playing. So on Saturdays, I would be playing football. Then at the grammar school, in my first year, I broke my collarbone and I was banned from playing rugby for some while. And it interfered with my cricket, because this was at the beginning of the war, 1940. We didn't have enough petrol to mow the cricket pitch. We didn't have enough land to play on, because the school fields had been taken over to build a new grammar school, which was rather slow to come into being simply because of the restrictions of the war. So we lost our cricket pitch, we lost our rugby pitch, and school sport started off bumbling along in a hiccupy sort of way. After that, we did get a playing field some distance away, a place called Holt House, which was the top of a great big hill, and the Holt House playing ground provided a cricket pitch, which was a little sporty, but nonetheless we had some good cricketers, some of whom, or one of whom, became an international later on in life, Alan Wharton, and we expected to play to that sort of standard. Alan played for the grammar school. He got a couple of centuries in his first two innings when I was in the school team. I entered the school first team when I was in the fifth form. I actually played for the school first rugby team when I was in the fourth form, but I found it a bit much. Although I was a big lad at that time, nonetheless, these people I played with were 3-4 years older, often quite hard, and I didn't go too much on that. I suddenly learnt what it was like. However, when I got into the fifth form, I'd toughened up a bit, we trained a lot harder, and by then the school had got on to a much more even keel with its sporting activities. Equally, I swam, we had house competitions, and I swam for the house. I became captain of the house, captain of cricket, captain of rugby, and I played for a local side, Skipton, which at that time was the only rugby team going in winter in the area, and all rugby players who were in reserved occupations or in the forces and coming home played for Skipton. And we played sides such as the Highland Division, and I played against two of the pre-war Scottish internationals. I was a scrum half, but for this particular match I was drafted in to being a centre, and I met a man there who was a Scottish international centre, and my mentor Frank Wellock, who was a Yorkshire County player, he said, come on lad, he said, we'll go up fast, knock them down and they won't come near us again, which we did. I owed a lot to Frank Wellock. He was a farmer, reserved occupation, and no teeth at the front. They'd all been kicked out when he was playing for Yorkshire. But I also played cricket against league sides. But at that time, the Lancashire League had lost the professionals. It was nearly all amateur. But we carried on playing, and so the grammar school actually played Lancashire League sides. And I remember getting 7-9 in one match. Rather a dicey wicket, but nonetheless, 7-9 was the best. I think it's the best I've ever done. But we played also schools, and I remember getting a hat-trick with the first three balls I bowled for Cone Grammar School against Keighley Grammar School. So I was pretty good at all sports, but that the sports like cricket, rugby, swimming, tennis, and hockey were not the end of it, because we used to go out into the hills, rock climbing, potholing, walking, riding, and swimming in the lakes.
This was organised by the school or just organised by yourself?
We used to organise the school. The school didn't organise us. Because if you remember early on, I said that I'd taken George Calloway down a pothole. He was our math teacher. And I mentioned we didn't lose him. No, we were quite capable of going out, spending nights out, sleeping in the countryside, going up into the Lake District. My brothers had motorbikes, and my second brother, Jack, had a Norton, and we used to go rock climbing in the Lake District during my holidays, and when I wasn't fire watching or working on farm camps.
And what about the OTC? Was there an OTC at Colne Grammar
No.
School?
No, my OTC was the fire watching, the fire service. Alan Wharton actually joined the fire service as a messenger. I was just simply a fire auxiliary.
What about other recreations? You mentioned going to the dances. What would a typical dance be like in Colne?
Well, it would be in Nelson, not Colne, because the Imperial Ballroom was, I think, the biggest ballroom in the world at that time. You could get 1,000 dancers on the floor. During the week, you could go and listen to top bands. You could listen to Carl Barito, who was a magnificent clarinetist. The resident band was also very good, and on a Saturday night, you could go to a dance for a shilling. And
what would the dances be like? Things have all changed now, obviously. What would a typical dance be like at the Imperial Ballroom?
Well, first of all, you go to the pub, and you get to the Imperial Ballroom a little later. But if you wanted to get in, you had to be there by 10 o'clock. The ballroom closed on the Saturday night at 11. Nice girls were not normally allowed to go, but they used to sneak off and go there because it was a wonderful place. During the week, yes, they could go. So we used to go to dances during the week, especially during the holidays, when it would be more expensive, depending on whether it was a police ball or what it was for, usually for some kind of war effort, and it would cost you half a crown to get in. And there would be, as I said earlier, over 1,000 people there on a very popular night. For one of these posh balls, there will be fewer people. There might be 250, 500. And they would start early. The band would immediately go into full swing. Quick steps, foxtrots. I wasn't too good at the quick steps because they were a bit fast for me. But nonetheless, you used to go and ask a girl, may I have this dance? And usually, they were pretty generous and they'd dance with you. Sometimes, if you didn't like the look of you, say, no, I'm with my friends. And those who were with their friends would stay with their friends. But at the end of the night, you would usually go home with your mates.
Was it a dry bar then?
Dry bar.
Dry room.
There would be a dry bar for the Saturday night dance. But the advantage of the police balls and whatever was that there was a bar. So you didn't have to go to your local pub. But, of course, the beer was a lot cheaper in the Clayton Arms or the Nelson Arms than in the...
Now, did you drink much? Because you'd be underage.
Well, I was 18 eventually. No, not a lot. But we used to... after all, beer was only about 8 pence a pint. And on 7 and 6 a week, that adds up to quite a lot of pints. But I saved my money. And I used to go on holidays, go rock climbing.
Now, so any events that you remember as we sort of as the war goes on? Before, I mean, you were at Colne Grammar School till 1943.
Yeah.
Anything happened during the years?
The big events were the great war efforts, and I think one of the most interesting ones was the Second Front in Europe Now. This was the war cry of the Communist Party. Remember, Nelson was a hotbed of communism. And the Russian war had begun. We were well aware of the battles for Stalingrad. And I was aware of the need to support Russia. I was aware of the efforts the British Communist Party were making to actually get money for support to provide effects for Russia. I wasn't quite sure what they did provide, but I was amazed at how they raised money. I listened to Palm Dutt, Harry Pollitt, they were the doyens of the Communist Party. And I also went because I was at school. This was how it linked in with school in a way. I went to night classes in Russian literature, because part of my history course was the history of Europe from 1495 to 1815, which included the rise of Russia, Peter the Great, even going back to Ivan the Terrible, but more so Peter the Great and Catherine the Great, and the growth of, I suppose you call, St. Petersburg then, or Petrograd, or Leningrad as it became aware of all those things, and of the Russian ballet, because in Burnley, the ballet, this was the Sadler's Wells ballet, had been, they'd escaped from Holland, I think. My wife would know that better than myself, for she was very keen on ballet, although we never met at that time. We used to go to the ballet in the one of the, it was a theatre in Burnley, the Vic, and we would go to watch, I suppose, some of the finest people of the times. We watched ballet and we went to Shakespeare. We had a cultural life as well. And
you're drifting away from the campaign for the Second Front.
Well, this is how it came about, yes, I agree. But we, all right. So, Second Front in Europe now, we went to all these different things. These were great events in our life. And we came back and talked with local people who were involved in the Communist Party. One was a railway man called Smith, and he also attended the Russian literature course. And I was amazed. The thing that amazed me was how these working men knew about Russian authors of whom I had no knowledge. Gogol. I knew of Chekhov, but I didn't know of many of the other people. And they were quite able to discourse on symbolism in Russian literature.
Now, what form did the campaign take?
Second Front in Europe Now.
And what was your involvement?
My involvement was simply to attend meetings. And I went to the Imperial Ballroom, where they did all kinds of things. It was initially built for skating, roller skating, but they did all in wrestling. They did had political meetings. It was a kind of, I suppose, Brighton of the North, and then these wonderful dancers.
So they'd have collections at the meetings.
They had collections, and the collections were quite amazing. How activists would get up and say, "I'm from the lads from Jimmy Nelson's, and I've got together £300, sums of money which were almost unbelievable." And they would hand an envelope with money in, then they'd send buckets round, and people would put money in. This was, and there were no strings attached. We never knew what happened to the money. I don't suppose they ever presented accounts. It was quite different in those days. People just gave. And then there were other funds, people coming round, Spitfire funds, our lads in wherever, and there were cigarette funds and so on, sending cigarettes out to people in the Western Desert. Because at that, when I was at home in the 40s, apart from the early part and Dunkirk, which I never felt that we'd lose the war. I never felt that with the Home Guard, with all the enthusiasm and whatever, that this country would go under. Whether it was naive, we weren't scared.
And what was at the root of this confidence, would you say?
Difficult to say, that we were an island people, that we had great faith in ourselves. After all, as school captain in many things, I was used to running things, and I had confidence to run things. I wasn't one poking other people up there. If there's something to be done, I would do it.
But you were running the war.
I was not running the war, and obviously I was